Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Recently on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, House rules broke down and tempers flared during a debate on an amendment related to an infrastructure bill. New York Democratic Congressman Max Rose and North Carolina Republican Congresswoman Virginia Fox clashed.
You say you're worried about deficit spending. Hallelujah, suddenly you're worried about it. You weren't worried about deficit spending when it came to endless wars. You weren't worried about deficit spending when it came to a tax scam. This conversation is in public. You don't get to go back to your districts now and say you're on the side of workers. But whose side are you on? Because there's one thing this amendment will do. It will boost corporate profits. It will put money in the hands of billionaires. And it will rip off workers. So today, out in public, you reveal yourself to be the hypocrites that you are. We're going to make sure that people remember this. Thank you. I yield back.
Members, I ask for the gentleman's word to be taken down. Members are reminded
to direct their remarks to the chair.
Madam Speaker, I ask for the gentleman's words to be taken down. I am not a hypocrite.
With all due respect, ma'am, you are.
Gentlemen will suspend.
Madam Speaker,
gentlemen will suspend.
I ask that the gentleman's words be taken down.
Now, this is not the worst thing that's ever happened on the House floor, but it does demonstrate that partisan tensions are high and bipartisan cooperation is not in fashion. Princeton University Professor of History and Public Affairs, Julian E. Zelizer, says today's knives out style of public discourse is the fruit of a tree planted by Newt Gingrich. Zelizer is the author of the new book, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. I asked him what was the problem with the old Republican Party.
The old Republican Party before the 1980s still had members committed to governance as much as partisanship. They still believed in certain restraints as to what was permissible in pursuit of partisan power. They still believed in certain norms and procedures and institutions being valuable so that Washington could work. And I argue that a lot of that went by the wayside, starting with Newt Gingrich, where partisanship became a sole priority and where there were almost no restraints really to what you could do to your opponents and what you can do to the institutions of government.
And the old Republican Party was seen also as a loser.
That is true. And that was Gingrich's argument. When he comes into office, he's elected in 1978 from a Georgia district. He argues Republicans played by the rules so much, they never had power in Congress, that they hadn't controlled the House or Senate since 1954. And his basic argument was, if they were going to win power, they were going to have to be more ruthless, more aggressive. And he literally says in a memo, they'd have to stop worrying about bipartisanship and civility, and they just have to do what was necessary to win. And in fact, that strategy will work for the Republicans, culminating in the 1994 takeover of Congress.
Armchair political analyst at the time would say things that Americans wanted Republicans to be president and Democrats to control the House because they saw as parents, as the mama and the papa, and they would like to have a tough dad, but they wanted to have a nice mom. And so they put Democrats in the House.
There's something to that. The other way to look at it was the country was simply in many different places by the 1980s, certainly still in the 1980s, over these key issues about the role of government at home and foreign policy, and that in the House, Democrats still maintained immense support, even in the Reagan Revolution era, as was evident with their control of the House, and they only lose the Senate from 81 to 87. And that was what Gingrich argued. When Reagan's elected, he says, if we don't take back the House, that division that you're referring to will prevent the Reagan Revolution from actually happening. We have to seize control of Congress, or the president will be a failure.
Many people saw the rise of Jim Wright as speaker as a backstop to the Reagan revolution, and he certainly challenged Reagan on many fronts, including foreign policy, which was unheard of at the time, that the speaker would be aggressive in that area with Central America and the Contras. This is a book not just about Newt Gingrich, but this is about the fall of Jim Wright.
Yeah, Jim Wright was really an old school Texas Democrat, a product of the 1940s and 50s period, a protege of Lyndon Johnson. And he opposes President Reagan on a number of fronts. He becomes speaker in 1987. He had been majority leader before that. One of the major ones is Central America, where he argues that the president's policies towards supporting the Contras was misguided. It was a fruitless effort. And Wright was not a dove at all. But he opposes this. He tries to actually broker a peace agreement in the region. And he rejects the idea that the president should have a free hand to decide what happens in foreign policy. And that's extraordinarily controversial. He also challenges him on domestic policy and argues that Reagan is going way too far in attacking the social safety net, from programs to help the homeless to programs to help the elderly.
So when Newt Gingrich, he gets elected to Congress, where does he come from? What is his mission?
Well, he is a guy who grew up in many places. His family was from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a working class community. He spent much of his youth as an army brat, where his stepfather kind of brings him to various military posts in Europe. And then he comes back to Georgia. And he goes to Emory College after marrying his high school math teacher. And then he goes to Tulane and gets a PhD in history. And after that, he moves to West Georgia College, which is in Carrollton, Georgia. And he only teaches for a little bit. Academics doesn't interest him very much. He's extraordinarily ambitious. And he has his first run for Congress in 1974 against a guy named John Flint, who was one of these old school Southern Democrats who had been around for a while. And he'll run twice against Flint, lose both times. And then finally in 78, Flint retires. And that's when Gingrich finally wins his seat. And he comes as this bomb throwing maverick to Capitol Hill with great ambitions about how Republicans could win control of the House.
And how was he viewed when he showed up in Washington, D.C.?
He was the kind of politician everyone stayed away from. Democrats saw him within a few years as a kind of McCarthyite Republican who was willing to just smear his opponents unfairly. Many Republicans, senior Republicans initially, were also very leery about connecting to him. They thought his tactics were far too aggressive. They thought what he was doing would ultimately be destructive to the Republican Party and to the democracy. So it takes Gingrich some time to prove himself, but he's always one of these politicians everyone stays away from, other than his closest allies.
At the time, we still had many of the guardrails or safety measures in place that had been established to try to keep politics from spinning out of control and getting too nasty. It seemed like, you know, this bipartisanship was still something highly valued in Washington, D.C. People who were branded outside of that world were not really given many opportunities to flourish in leadership, with committees, with plum assignments, and they weren't given a voice in the national media. And the national media was very tightly constrained at the time. You had major newspapers, and you had a few networks, and that was pretty much it. But then this was a time when that was changing. Can you talk about that and how that gave Newt Gingrich an opening?
Yeah, Gingrich is masterful in terms of his understanding of the media. And even when a lot of politicians were staying away from him, he understood how he could use the media to his advantage. There was obviously conservative talk radio, which starts to expand in the 1980s, which offers him a platform. He's even a guest host on a local Washington show called Confrontation, which eventually becomes Crossfire on C-SPAN. But cable television is really what attracts him. And one story I tell in the book is that in 1984, he and his cabal of supporters, he has a small caucus of conservatives, they went on television every night at the end of the day when the chamber was empty, and they would stand in front of the C-SPAN camera, which only showed the person speaking, and they'd accuse Democrats of being weak on defense. They'd argue that Democrats didn't support Ronald Reagan's war in Central America, and they would call out specific Democrats asking them to respond. And what the public couldn't see was the chamber was empty. No one was there. But it looked like the Democrats were basically without an answer. This becomes a big scandal when Speaker Tip O'Neill turns the cameras around and shows that no one's actually there. But it was one example where Gingrich understood that this medium offered a lot of opportunities. He also sees that investigative journalists after Watergate, who are doing hard work of trying to uncover the connections between money and politics, that their stories could become great fodder in the partisan wars that he was fighting against the Democrats.
There were also Democrats who used that platform as well.
It was, and certainly partisanship was something both parties engaged in. Jim Wright himself was known as a pretty tough partisan in terms of holding his members in line and trying to limit what Republicans can do, which is part of why Gingrich was attractive. But there were differences. Ultimately, Democrats like Jim Wright believed in government. This was at the heart of their philosophy. So there were limits to what they would do if they would undermine the ability of government to function. Gingrich comes from an anti-government party, which was much more suspect of the role of government. So he was willing to go much further, and his colleagues were as well, I argue, because a dysfunctional government didn't necessarily undercut their policy agenda.
Julian E. Zelizer is the author of Burning Down the House, about the political rise of Newt Gingrich and a take-no-prisoner style of partisanship that has taken hold in American politics. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm speaking with Julian E. Zelizer, author of Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party.
What's remarkable and why the Jim Wright story is so important is that when Gingrich is on the verge of bringing down the Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, which is a historic moment in Washington, the Speaker's the most powerful legislator in Congress. No Speaker had been pressured to resign in American history. The Republicans elect Gingrich to be the House Minority Whip, which is an important leadership position, and it put him on the path to becoming Speaker. So it's not simply Gingrich coming to Washington, it's the Republicans deciding by the end of the decade that his methods are the methods they want to have up top rather than just on the fringes. And that's an important transformation.
When we talk about bipartisan breaking down and this gridlock happening in Washington, D.C., you often hear, well, it takes two to tango.
Yeah, I think there's different kinds of partisanship. And I think I'm on the page that we have to understand the parties engaged in their partisanship in very different ways. And there was an asymmetry between how the parties developed since the 1980s. And I think Republicans from Gingrich to Trump practiced a much more ruthless form of partisanship that had much bigger consequences for the institutions of government than Democrats. Not that Democrats weren't partisan, not that Democrats didn't have their more aggressive figures, but there's a fundamental difference in how the parties went about their business and who shaped the tenor of today's politics.
Asymmetrical accusations of ethical behavior, where one side can lobby accusations against the other side, and they're basically immune or impervious to those same accusations coming back at them. Is that what you saw here?
Well, that's definitely true. Although the heart of the story is still about Newt Gingrich, I was just as fascinated with the Democrats. And this whole House of Cards-like scandal revolves around Gingrich finding stories about Jim Wright where he didn't actually, wasn't proven to have broken any ethical rules, any legal rules, but he takes stories about things that Wright had done that seemed a little unsavory, or relationships that he had with members, with people living in the district. And Gingrich blows them up into a scandal that, in his words, is making Wright the most corrupt speaker in American history. And what's fascinating was that by the summer of 1989, Democrats are basically telling Wright privately, and they're whispering to reporters, step down, we're not going to support you anymore. They have much less tolerance and are much more fearful about what this will do to their party than Republicans, who have a very different approach. Gingrich is accused of scandals as he's going after Wright, but it doesn't shake him at all. He has no shame. He just keeps moving forward, and very few Republicans abandon him. So there's a difference in how the parties treat these issues.
And the accountability is really what it all comes down to. Who holds politicians accountable? And it becomes, I guess, their voters, their supporters, and how much will voters, if voters don't care, then you're golden, right?
Well, I think that's true. If your electorate will tolerate all kinds of behavior, ultimately, you will have a safe seat. You will win re-election as president. But that's extremely important. The other way we do hold politicians accountable, or we try to, were through ethics rules that Congress passed after Watergate, which tried to create some other restraints besides the vote on behavior. But one of the things Gingrich does there is he takes those ethics rules, and he also turns those into a weapon of partisan warfare. And I think after the 80s, we kind of lost those rules as a real measure of accountability. So what we're left with really is the electorate, and the two parties have electorates that seem to have very different standards at this point.
Speaker Wright was eventually undone by a book deal that was called Corrupt, but Newt Gingrich also had a similar book deal. But can you talk about how a book deal could be so bad that it could take down a speaker?
Well, that's the answer is you have an opponent who could make it look so bad that it creates that political pressure, meaning there were restrictions after Watergate on how much any member of Congress could earn giving speeches, how much could they earn through honoraria. But those rules didn't cover book royalties. So many members of Congress sold books and they made that money much more freely. And Jim Wright had a book of speeches and short writings that he would sell, and he would sell it to groups when he spoke to them in bulk. It was a very cheap book. That didn't break any ethic rule. It didn't break any law. It probably wasn't the best decision. But in itself, that couldn't bring down a speaker. What it took was an opponent like Wright, like Gingrich, who could frame it and shape it and talk about that action almost as if it had been a criminal activity. And that's how he does it. And he does it through the media. He does it through the kind of Washington circles, and he's very successful at it.
It's this false outrage. It seems these scandals are so cute and quaint, looking back at them now and saying, that is what brought down a speaker? You got to be kidding me, considering what we've seen recently and what we've seen over the past 20 years. The House banking scandal, which was something that Newt Gingrich was able to use to win, help him win the House majority, along with the Contract for America, where they found that a certain some Democratic congressmen were using the House bank. They would cash checks, and those checks would sometimes bounce, and then they wouldn't have to pay a penalty or a fee or anything, and then they eventually would have to pay the money back. But this was turned into another scandal.
That's exactly right. And I'd add some Republicans were also wrapped in that scandal. And it fell, though, on the Democrats who control the House. It wasn't about illegal behavior. It was just finding things about the legislative branch that definitely could be better, or stories like that, which didn't sound very good, and blowing them up. And it's the blowing them up part that determined whether the scandal would be devastating. That banking scandal turned into yet another piece of the puzzle. Jim Wright, the banking scandal that culminates in that 94 election. Because Gingrich was laser focused not on the argument of liberalism versus conservatism. He was always focused on the argument that the Democratic establishment was corrupt and that the Republican Revolution was about taking down that establishment. So those scandals fit perfectly into that narrative.
But not only did Newt Gingrich sort of find these raw items and refine them into an issue that they could turn into a scandal, but there was also found candidates across the United States who would challenge sitting Democrats, and then they would offer them all of this material, point by point talking points. They would get the facts from them every day about things that they wanted them to talk about in their challenge against sitting Democrats. And this is what helped bring about the Republican majority of the House.
That's exactly right. And Gingrich, from the early 80s through the time he is trying to get Republicans to win control, he's very concerned and always writing other Republicans about how they should speak, what kinds of words they should
use. He would send them cassette tapes.
He would send them cassette tapes through something called GOPAC that he controlled, and memos. And there's one that you could still find on the web, which I mentioned on the book, which tells Republicans, how do you speak like Newt? And it emphasizes using certain words about Democrats, saying they're sick, saying they're corrupt, saying they're radical. He often used the term loony left. He was very focused on this, again, because of his concern about how things sounded in the media. And this language really catches on, and a whole generation of Republicans becomes comfortable speaking like Newt and using these kinds of terms to speak about their opponents.
What was the role in the media of all this?
Well, I think very often it wasn't just about the conservative media helping Gingrich, as we often talk about today with President Trump. It was also about reporters who were just doing their work, but didn't totally see how their material would become used by the partisans. So whether it was Brian Lamb and C-SPAN not really understanding how his station back in 1984 would become this platform for Gingrich to lob some attacks on the Democrats, or whether it was all these investigative journalists who were covering Jim Wright and who were asking legitimate questions about his relations in the district and questions about influence and power, how Gingrich would just take them, even if they weren't fully cooked, even if they were just initial stories, and then turn them into a narrative of corruption. I don't think they fully understood that. And I think that's a story we keep seeing today.
But the Republicans understood how reporters are supposed to report, and that they're able to use these rules of the game in order to reach an audience and deliver a message and also weaponize the press, demonize the press. This was all part of their game book.
Absolutely. And Gingrich spoke about this idea, and I have some quotes in the book. He would explain to fellow Republicans that what the press wants is confrontation. And if you give them confrontation, you will get exposure, and ultimately that will bring you power. So whether it was confrontation with journalists, talking about journalists not really being objective and being part of this liberal establishment, or literally engaging in controversial kind of sizzling moments with Democrats, like the cam scam story that I mentioned earlier, he understood that would almost inevitably land him on the front pages and on the major networks. And he was right. It worked extremely well. And that was part of the whole strategy for bringing down the speaker.
Another speaker who was brought down was Newt Gingrich.
Yes, almost inevitable as we look back in the history. Part of the reason it was inevitable is that throughout his career, Gingrich, who talked about ethics, who went after leaders and Democrats for the way they behaved, he was always dogged by accusations of how he behaved, whether it was his personal life and affairs that he had, or whether it was his book deal, or the way he used tax-exempt money for political purposes. All of this always became part of the Gingrich story, and it culminates in 1998. After his speaker, he had been fined for ethics in the middle of the Clinton impeachment. Republicans ask him to step down because the 98 midterms don't go well, and he himself is engaged in a personal relationship, which sounds a lot like what's at the center of the impeachment. The other part of this is, look, what Gingrich accomplished through his attacks was the idea that anyone could be brought down. And we were no longer in an era where speakers could expect to just keep their power indefinitely. So it was almost fitting that he himself would only be able to retain his power. And part of the reason that Republicans felt comfortable bringing him down, the guy who created the revolution, was that was what his revolution was about. And so he himself had to live by the rules he created.
We're taking a break, and when we come back, more conversation with Julian Ezelizer about Newt Gingrich, Jim Wright, and the hyper-partisanship that has infected American politics. Stay with us. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Let's get back to the conversation with Julian Ezelizer. He is a Princeton University professor of history and public affairs and the author of Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. When Donald Trump began his run for the presidency, Newt Gingrich was one of the first few to go on cable TV and legitimize that Donald Trump could be president and that he could be a historic figure.
Oh, yes. Gingrich has been connected to the Trump presidency directly. One connection I learned about in the book was when Gingrich ran for president in 2012, one of his top advisors was Kellyanne Conway, who later will become President Trump's top advisor. But when Trump is really getting going, Gingrich is one of his fans, one of his supporters. Gingrich is one of the finalists to be vice president. He'll ultimately lose out to Governor Mike Pence at the time. But Gingrich was being seriously considered. And since President Trump has been in office, Gingrich has written a series of books basically boasting about what the Trump presidency has done and why it's so important to the future of America. So these are two individuals who are now directly linked in their fate.
You're right how Newt Gingrich was thought about as a possible vice presidential candidate for Trump?
I do. I start the book with that story. Although I wrote this book before Trump, most of the book was written before Trump was even running. And I didn't think of this as a book about the current period so much as really the 1980s and the road to the Tea Party. But yes, he was one of the finalists. He's even flown to Indiana in the final days to meet with Trump advisors and the Trump kids and has a long interview. But he goes on Fox television when he's in Indiana for this interview. And he's very open. He has an interview with Sean Hannity. And he tells Sean Hannity that both he and Trump are pirates, that's how they approach life. That's how they approach politics. And he admits that two pirates on the ticket might be a little too much. And he says this as Trump's still considering him. And I think at some level, that might have also been the thinking of the Trump team, as well as the fact that Gingrich insists on the spotlight in ways which Trump might not have appreciated.
And Mike Pence seemed to be more appropriate for that role.
Exactly. Low-key, less visible, and more willing to let Trump dominate the airwaves.
So anyone who looks at their email is going to be getting these constant pitches for money and we need you to jump in here and give us $5 for this party, that party. Newt Gingrich's name was frequently attached to some of these emails asking me for money. Even though I've never given money to a political party, I'd still get these emails. Does Newt still have some sort of cachet with the rank and file Republican voter?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he's seen as part of a senior establishment. I think observers often make the mistake, this happened in 2016, when they talked of the Republican establishment as being people like the Bush family, but it's really people like Gingrich who are the establishment. And I think Republican appeals still focus on Gingrich because he in fact does embody where the party came from and even where it is today. He's still a spokesperson on Fox television for the administration who you see speaking all the time. And so it makes sense that Republican fundraising appeals will talk about him. I wouldn't be surprised if occasionally Democrats throw him in their appeals because he's equally reviled in Democratic circles as this figure who, in the memory of people who grew up in the 80s and 90s, and even the early 2000s, he was the face of the party that transformed into where we are right now.
Had he not been named Newt Gingrich, that name probably would have turned up in a Harry Potter book.
That's absolutely true. I mean, names matter. And he had one that would have fit in either context, I guess.
And so when he's on Fox News, is he brought out as a soothsayer, as someone who understands these dark arts, who can assure many of the viewers who really like that red meat of conservative talking points that he knows what's what?
Yeah, and I think there's an element that if he legitimates what's going on or he helps make sense of what's going on, he can combine that role as senior party statesperson with former history professor, and it makes some sense of what you hear from President Trump, which might sound more like a rant and a rave. But Gingrich still likes to throw out the red meat all the time. And even in recent weeks, he's been out there talking about, radical assaults on the democracy and a left-wing mob, that sort of rhetoric you hear from him. So he's also willing to still do what he's been doing since the 1980s. And he knows that every time he says stuff like this, he gets himself on the front pages or on the Twitter feed. I guess that's our modern version. And so the rhetoric hasn't changed that much.
But I think about social learning as this concept that people learn and generations learn from previous generations and what to do, what not to do. Is there any evidence that these same old tricks are wearing thin, or these are just something that's just baked into our political DNA? We're always going to fall for it like Charlie Brown in a football. Are we developing, getting smarter, trying to find people who we can elect to office, who are interested in governing, who wants a nation that will operate and prevent things like pandemics and economic meltdowns?
Well, from the perspective of 220, July 220, it would be hard to reach that conclusion with a firm answer, yes, they are out there. Meaning a lot of certainly the GOP right now with President Trump at the top of the ticket is still running according to the Gingrich playbook. And it's not clear that the party's changing. We're in a pandemic where you see behavior from the White House and from many governors that really continually places partisanship above the greatest public health care crisis that we faced. So, I mean, maybe the party will change. Maybe there'll be a new generation of leaders in both parties that really are able to transform the ways and means of Washington. But right now, I would probably be replicating Jim Wright, who, when he resigned, made this great speech. And he says that if he resigns, maybe Washington could avoid the mindless cannibalism that was going to sweep through the city if this didn't stop. And what Wright didn't see was it wasn't even close to ending, that it was just the first chapter of a much longer story. And we might still be in the middle of the story rather than the end.
Sure, because when Wright resigns, thinking that he was going to do, or he's saying that he was going to do the right thing for the good of the party, the good of the government, the good of the country. And then Newt Gingrich comes right back. He says, I got a list of 10 more. That's 10 exactly, more Democrats. I got to come down.
No, that's exactly right. And I talk about the mindless cannibalism speech, which is really a great moment of political rhetoric that I urge people to listen to. But Wright was totally wrong in that Gingrich had no intention of stopping. I found handwritten notes by Gingrich that he took as he was listening to Wright speak, where A, he's furious that Wright is blaming partisanship rather than his own behavior. But he jots down at the end, and even though he's all worked up, Gingrich, that what really matters is that since they're speaking about him, it shows that he had arrived. And as soon as this is over, Gingrich keeps moving to the next list, and he goes to the banking scandal, et cetera, et cetera. There was no intention for Wright to be the last stop in this strategy.
Gingrich does come up with the Contract for America. That was a big deal. What was in that again?
Yeah, it had a list of different promises from the Republicans about what they would do if they gained control of the House in 1994. And it ranged from term limits for members of Congress to more fiscally responsible measures to balance the budget. And it was really not meant to be a detailed policy plan. What it was meant for, it was published in TV Guide. It was a tear out that people could put on their refrigerators. And it was a gimmick. Gingrich wanted to nationalize the 94 elections, and he thought that this Contract with America, which he publicizes also on television, would be a great way to frame what the Republicans were about and to give voters this sense there was a concrete list, like term limits, that the Republicans would follow through on if they won control.
It never happened. I mean, they voted people in to perform the Contract for America, and nothing on this list ever came about.
No, that's right. And some of the stuff they never even tried. Some of it wasn't going to happen. And many issues like fiscal responsibility, which was part of the act, the Republicans really moved in the opposite direction. That, you know, they were as engaged in deficit spending as any Democrat had ever been. So it wasn't about fulfilling it that we remember the contract for, because it was all unfulfilled mostly. It was really about the campaign strategy that it embodied.
But it was trying to capitalize on grievances that many people had about Washington, D.C., like we see today, and making a promise that we're going to make these big changes. And once you vote them in the power, vote them in the office, those changes never actually happen, which is why it kind of created this failure created an opening for Donald Trump. Donald Trump ran against both the Democrats and this Republican Party that Newt Gingrich represented.
No, that is true. The failures of the Republicans from that Gingrich era in terms of policy, which range from President George H.W. Bush raising taxes in 1990 instead of decreasing them, to the Republicans in the 90s, under Gingrich, not passing the promised constitutional amendments for term limits or balancing the budget, to President George W. Bush's failures overseas, Trump pitted himself against that Republican establishment. But even in doing that, he was essentially taking the Gingrich playbook. He was just making the old Republicans, who had been in power now for some time, the same people who Gingrich had targeted when it was the Democrats. And it proved to be very effective.
Julian E. Zelizer is the author of Burning Down the House, about the political rise of Newt Gingrich and the take-no-prisoner style of partisanship that we see now in American politics. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and I'm speaking with Julian E. Zelizer about his new book, burning down the House, Newt Gingrich, the fall of a speaker, and the rise of the new Republican Party. Can the genie go back into the bottle? Is there a way that the American can American politics can be restored to bipartisanship, where we try to work towards a greater good and not so much personal destruction?
Not easily. It's certainly not going to be the replacement of President Trump with Joe Biden that would transform this country. I just don't think it's that easy. This is really cooked into our politics now, and the damage has been done over the decades, so it's not easy to fix. I think most likely you would see a change, A, if there's an election loss so severe in one party like the GOP, the kind of landslide we haven't had since 1984, that actually forces members to reconsider the kind of politics they practice, because it's not in their interest to keep moving in the same direction. B, we would have to have real institutional reforms that get at some of the issues that are underlying the partisanship, the way money and politics works, the way districts are crafted, those sorts of issues. And finally, a point you made earlier, we will need generational change. And there is a question, will the generation of Americans who are now growing up as young people in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of the kind of political chaos that has been normalized, will they, rather than embrace that and just double down, will they push for a different way? I think those are the three different signs I would look for if things are going to get better. But in the short term, it's hard for me to see any of that happening right now.
Two of Newt Gingrich's acolytes, Tom DeLay and Dick Armey, were instrumental in creating these districts that were hard Republican or hard Democrat. And many people see that type of districting as why we have these polar opposites. And there's no room in the middle for a politician to find a base and to survive. If we were to somehow get through the current situation, and regardless of who's president or who runs the House and the Senate, get towards a vast gerrymandering reform where we're able to have congressional districts that are a mix of both sides, left and right, and is that a way we can get towards a back away from the edge of this hyper-partisan type atmosphere?
It would make things better, but it wouldn't be a total cure. Obviously, the Senate, for example, is incredibly partisan now, and their districts don't really matter. The media is now a very important part of fueling the partisanship, very partisan media that we have in certain segments. That's not impacted by gerrymandering. But when you think of reform, it's different pieces of reform. And yes, in the House of Representatives, the fact that members are looking at these districts that are incredibly solid and where the main threat is not from the other party, but from you being primaried from someone closer to the extreme, that creates immense pressure on members to stay to the party line. So I don't think it's a cure-all, but I do think that's the kind of reform that could push against some of what we've been discussing.
Money in politics is another issue, and Newt Gingrich also created a revolution in raising money for people he wanted to run for Congress.
He was great at it, and he took this world that comes as the Watergate reforms break down, where private money starts to flow in to members through interest groups that either represent certain industries or single issues, and he centralizes the distribution of that money. Tom DeLay will also be very important in this. And so when Republicans run, they count on these leadership PACs for funds. And if you want that money, you have to stick to the party line and you have to do what the party says. And so if you don't break that, the party leaders continue through today, through tomorrow, to have immense control over what the rank and file does.
Jim Wright, what is he remembered for other than being the speaker who had to quit?
I think that is what he's remembered for. I think he's remembered as one of the last gasps of an older era of politics. I do think people who remember him or people who study politics a little more do remember this era of Democratic politics from the 1930s to 70s, where this basic belief in government was so important for creating a social safety net, for protecting certain social rights. He embraced that with a kind of enthusiasm that today a lot of Democrats are a little more reluctant to have. And I think he's remembered for being a public servant and loving being a public servant. He loved Congress so much. That's why this was all so devastating to him. And I think we look back at a figure like him with a bit of nostalgia because that generation of politicians is no longer with us.
Newt Gingrich, has the political obituary for him been written?
Well, no, he's still active and who knows what he will do next. But I do think a big part of that, yes, it will revolve around what he did to national politics and the kind of partisanship that he normalized. I think that's integral not only to his story, but to his legacy in Washington. And people who don't like him will read that and remember him with a real sense of distaste in their mouth about what happened because of him. His supporters will probably read that and admire him as a warrior of the right. But I think either way, this impact that he had on what it means to be partisan and how far you can go in that fight, that's his legacy. And that will be ultimately the biggest consequence of his role in politics.
But Newt Gingrich was doing what he thought was right and proper, and he was going to do whatever he had to do to accomplish his goals. Isn't there a failure from the Democrats to counter him? That's part of the story.
Absolutely, and in the final weeks of Jim Wright's career as Speaker, the Ethics Committee conducts an investigation and releases an initial report, which is based on very thin evidence and just a preliminary look at newspaper stories, and says there's room for further investigation and we're going to do that. And then we'll decide what's warranted. And it's at that moment, before the Ethics Committee does any of that, that Democrats decide, most Democrats, they're starting to do this whisper campaign, resign. They're scared about the 90 midterm elections. And they had a choice. Democrats could not have done that. They could have said, we're going to stand by the speaker. They didn't have to get rid of him. They didn't have to pressure him into stepping down. And had they stood by Wright and had Gingrich's tactics failed, you could have had a very different path. So Democrats conceding to Gingrich at that moment empowered what Gingrich was trying to do. And I do believe they're responsible. They're also responsible in that they hadn't cleaned house totally. Since Watergate. I think Democrats in Congress didn't go as far as they needed to in terms of reforming how politics worked. And so Gingrich was able to find these examples to exploit that made a little bit of sense. And so on both fronts, I don't think Democrats can say their hands are clean in terms of how Gingrich ultimately came to power.
Julian E. Zelizer is a Princeton University professor of history and public affairs and the author of Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.